how they will answer in voices so sweet. Hey, you and Eve, by and by, in that glorious land.
That is a song called The Preacher and the Slave. It was written by Joe Hill, the Wobblies, the IWW leader. It was performed there by Utah Phillips, and we're playing that because two reasons, really. On this day in history in 1909, the IWW, the Wobblies songbook, was released, and as a protest piece in 1909 on this day. And to me, The Preacher and the Slave, and to our staff, is appropriate for the discussion we're having today. And joining me in the studio here is Dr. Lester Spence, who is the Center for Emerging Media's scholar in residence. He is associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of the book Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. And good to see you.
It's good to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner and talk at steinershow.org. You can write us emails there. Log on to our Facebook pages. We've seen some stuff on Facebook, so I'll go there in a moment. So please join us there. We'd love to have you be part of this conversation. And I'm thinking about a lot of things today when it comes to Ferguson. So many things have happened, and we'll talk about a lot of these. There was a new poll put out by Pew Charitable Trust that we'll talk about and share with you, at least the highlights of it. We haven't had a chance to look at all of it, but what we know is significant in terms of how America is looking at Ferguson and who's looking at it now. We are looking at a place now with roadblocks and school closings and people imprisoned in their own community. They're talking about all these people arrested last night. One of those people was a 90-year-old Holocaust, a Jewish woman, a Holocaust survivor named Hedy Epstein, was arrested on Monday during the protests in Ferguson. And she said, "I've been doing this since I was a teenager. I didn't think I would have to do it when I was 90. We need to stand up today so that people won't have to do this when they're 90. And she was arrested in Ferguson. And remembering something that Mandela said as we kick off this conversation and hear Lester Spence right now about what he's thinking in his commentary before we go on to the rest of mine and yours at 410-319-8888. Mandela said in 1962, "Government violence can do only one thing, and that is to breed counterviolence." Lester Spence.
Yeah, so there are a number of things. It's you know, times like this, like a number of us have lost, like, it's funny because there's a weird way, time and space get compressed when incidents like these happen, right? So what do I mean? Ferguson is on Central Standard Time. We're on Eastern Standard Time. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, we're on the same time, right?
Right, right.
Spatially speaking, St. Louis is approximately, I think, 1,000 miles away. I used to live in St. Louis. I used to be a professor there before
I was
right
here. I forgot.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, but it's 1,000 miles away, but we might as well be there. Right. A number of my friends are actually there where they're covering the issues. Journalist Jelani Cobb, who's a professor at University of Connecticut, has been writing pieces for The New Yorker, has been in Ferguson, or whether it's people who are just, you know, people who are still there, who live there. It's in a weird way, this brings kind of everybody, specifically black people, together. And it doesn't matter what class. So one of the things I try to talk about when I come on the show is I try to emphasize the politics within black communities, usually based on class, sometimes around gender and other issues, right? So we can talk about the way that resources are distributed within black communities. But an issue like police violence, it actually affects everybody, right? So just, I think, last week, 2 weeks ago, a journalist in San Bernardino was killed by police on a bicycle because they mistook him for a burglar. Trayvon Martin, you know, solid middle-class background, two parents, et cetera, et cetera. This happens to all of us. And again, it just kind of brings us together. And it doesn't matter. We've had discussions on your show about whether we need capitalist, whether we should think about post-capitalist economies. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about a socialist economy, a capitalist economy, a communist economy. Populations deemed to be black are always at the bottom. They always are the ones falling through the cracks. And it doesn't matter how you organize the economy. So those are some of the things, just a couple of things I'm thinking about that I think bear further discussion and further kind of political movement, so to speak.
No, I think those are important things to wrestle with. I was thinking about a guest we had on yesterday, Adara Ayera, who comes on the show a great deal. And she was harassed by the police just 2 weeks ago. Just to put this out there, she's going to come on the show to talk about this. But Adara was stopped coming back dressed to the nines in her car by herself, coming back from the Associated Black Charities ball, pulled over by the police. They said her lights were out. She said, no, you can see my lights are on. They're not out. They said, where have you been? She said, she told him where he was. Then the policeman, in total disrespect, says, oh, you're a party girl? And started harassing her. And, you know, this is a brilliant, cultured woman, a leader of our community, mm-hmm. coming back from a gala. Oh, you're a party girl.
Yeah, yeah.
So that,
right?
Right.
That's like it, right?
And so, you know, and that is part of this. And I think that there's so many things to talk about with this going on in Ferguson. The people who've written, be coming on the show later this week, Peniel Joseph, who wrote about the generation divide taking place that happened in the 60s, happening now in Ferguson with young people. But it's more than racial generation divide. It's perspective divide as well. And we'll talk about that. And mm-hmm. I want Lester's thoughts on that. And, you know, that Jesse Burns, who was a truck driver for UPS, who just bought a house in Ferguson, has not been able to get to his house because of the roadblocks. He was there one day, and he told the story about not being able to get to his home. Where he finally got there on Monday, snuck in, was able to mow his lawn, see what was going on. It was right where young Miss Brown was killed. He said, I believe it's the people that are not in this area that's creating all the havoc. And the police are instigating this. Why do they need to throw fire or gas bombs at these youths? Why? This is not the solution. And bringing in the National Guard is not the solution either. They need to sit and listen to what the people have to say. That's where they need to start.
So it's important to bear in mind, particularly whether you're following this just through listening on the news or whether you're following this through social media or the TV, what the police are doing just pales in comparison to the level of violence that's actually been caused in Ferguson, right? So as far as I know, in Ferguson, a Quick Trip was burned down, and I know some windows were smashed in a McDonald's, right? Those are the incidents I know. So just by way of comparison, in the Detroit riot of 67, or the Detroit rebellion of 67, 2,510 stores were looted or burned, $40 million to $80 million in damages, approximately 470 folks injured, 43 people dead. Looking at 53 people died during the riots, approximately 2,000 people injured, estimates of material loss between $800 million and $1 billion.
Wow.
What we're talking about now is nothing like that. What we are talking about is a nonviolent demonstration with the accept of the police. That's really what we're talking about. If we think about this, absolutely, if we just think about the Quick Trip and McDonald's in Ferguson, without thinking about these other cases, it makes it seem like they're, combined with the images, it makes it seem like there are these incredibly intense bursts of violence and then violent nonviolence. No, if you think about what happened in the wake of similar instances, what we have is an incredibly disciplined and incredibly nonviolent set of protests that have been consistently interrupted by violence by the police.
And I think that's part of what we're not seeing. And I think, we've heard all about well, let's go to the phones here. We've heard all about the shots being fired, and I don't know how that occurred, where it came from, who shot who threw what first. But the majority of what's going on here has to do with people pushing back, nonviolent protesters demanding justice. You saw Don Lemon's on CNN. I watched it this morning, where he was standing on the side of the highway with hundreds of protesters from Ferguson and people from outside Ferguson. There were hundreds of white people in these protests as well who came in from outside to stand in solidarity, being literally pushed. He was being pushed. Journalists have been arrested for reporting the news here, being pushed.
You know, police are doing something wrong when Don Lemon is the one that's getting pushed. Because as much of an apologist as Don Lemon is, you know, to bring some levity, but real talk, Don Lemon is an extreme apologist. You know there's something going on if he's the one getting pushed by the police.
So your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Judith, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Judith.
Appreciate you taking my call. I was hanging on all afternoon yesterday.
I apologize, but I'm glad you're with us now.
God bless you. Listen, I was yesterday, one of the gentlemen you had on the panel made a statement about he got angry with a caller who called about young people doing things and young people needing to get themselves together. The caller was saying that. And one of the panelists, he has two sons, he mentioned. He has two sons, and he got very angry at the caller, and he made a statement that angered me.
What was that?
He said that the elders aren't teaching, who's teaching young people how to behave, the next generation, the elders aren't teaching them. And that angered me. I'm not an elder. I don't have children. But I'm 56 years old. I've been in Baltimore, raised and born all my life. I worked in the streets. I worked with the homeless. I've worked at all that for more than 30 years, and now I'm a disabled, getting disability. So I worked with these people. I know the streets. The elders are raising the children of the next generation. Most of them are in jail. Others of them are either on drugs or lazy. Not all. There's a great group of young people that are doing amazing things, right? I'm talking about Baltimore. And it's all over this country, but I'm talking about Baltimore, African-Americans in Baltimore. And if young people, the next generation, doesn't want to listen to the elders and learn of their history and learn of different ways of doing things, then stop blaming the elders. Because many elders, many grandmothers and grandfathers are raising their children, whether they're in jail or not. I have friends right here in my apartment building who are raising the children of their children. And that angered me when you start attacking the various groups within our own group. That's not any solution. Because you don't know all of what's going on. And people say, I'm in the streets. I did this, I did that. In the streets does not mean you walking down the street seeing people. I worked in the streets. I went in the homes of every ghetto and every suburb between Baltimore City and Baltimore County, Howard County, Harford County. I've been there. And it's not just even a racial thing. The whites, Hispanics, they're raising the children of younger generations. So, younger generations are amazingly brilliant.
I think what you're saying, Judith, is really important. Hold on for just a second. Lester, because when I made the comment about Peniel's article, you made a face, and I think it's something in tune, perhaps, maybe I'm wrong, what Judith was saying. What's your perspective here?
So the idea that there's first, the median age is 31 years. For black people, is 31. Right, that is half of the people at 30 are above that 31. Half the people below it. If you're 56, you need to just claim your elder status. If you're 56 years old, you are an elder. You got to kind of claim it. You can't kind of run away from that. but the idea that black politics is categorized, that you can really understand black politics by way of a generational divide, is something that we've been hearing in a number of different ways for at least 50 years, right? Going back to the civil rights movement, if you think about the black power youth against the civil rights movement elders, even though Martin Luther King was only like about 10 years, 11 years
older
than those
folks. He was in his 20s and 30s for most of the time. He was struggling.
Right,
or he was killed at 39.
So, I mean, I think that what's more accurate to say is there are these enduring political differences, and then these political differences have an age component. But to the extent there's that age stuff going on, it's really the economy at work, right? So when the sister talks about, I mean, my first house was in, we rented a church parsonage in Ashburton. And we saw that phenomenon. We saw a number of grandparents raising grandkids because their parents were absent. That's a function of the economy, right? So people my parents' age, and we've talked about this a number of times, they had steady jobs where they knew that once they got the job, they were going to stay in that job no matter whether they were educated or just had a high school background until they died. That economy drops out. That has a very significant effect on how people in their 50s and older perceive the world, how people my age perceive the world, and how folks 20-year-olds and younger perceive the world. Somebody 20 years old can't possibly imagine the idea of getting a job at 18 that can make them enough money legitimately to actually buy a house, to pay for the educations of their kids and their grandkids if they chose to have them. That's an economy.
And I think it's also, let's go back to phones. Georgia, thanks so much for raising the issue. I'm glad you got through today. Your voice is very important here. And I think that the other piece of this is that it is a question, I think, of people, period, and many of the young people in the poorest communities feeling absolutely dislocated, not part of society, not part of the conversation, left out. Schools are miserable. The harassed by the police, dislocation, and stuck in poverty, and that's the response we're getting. Not generational. This is class in some ways.
Right. So we focus on the youth because we see the youth. But if we just, for example, looked at elders, like real elders, I'm willing to bet that you'd find a significant difference between people who had the resources to live in retirement homes. And now we're just talking about black folk, and then people who don't have the resources and are struggling, many of them still having to find jobs.
Right.
You're going to have a significant difference, and we're talking about people who are the same age.
You look at Tyrone West's family, the elders in that family are deeply involved in that struggle in the city, not just the young people in that family.
Yes.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Bill in Baltimore.
Hello?
Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, first, Mark, how are you doing? Let me say hello to your guest.
I'm very well.
I'm Bill Goodman. You know, I've been in Baltimore about 25 years. My original home is St. Louis. And I have our family members, children, as well as my parents, still in St. Louis. But, you know, personally, I think one of the problems in terms of being an activist myself is that everything that's happening in St. Louis, this is about that people want a different kind of leadership. And, you know, don't say like that's what people are trying for, but people tired of the same type of leadership that we have had over and over and over. And what happened to Michael Brown, I mean, I think the thing is that if this was just Michael Brown, it'd be one thing. But when people just see this over and over and over and over, then I just think that, you know, at some point people reach the limits. And, you know, for me, I'm going to just say this. I think the fear and what people really need to be looking for, I think St. Louis is just a prime example of what's going to take place across this nation when these types of things happen. Because what happened with everything that happened and people rioting and everything else, that's what made you get attention. That's why the president said something. That's why Eric Holder is going to St. Louis. You know, because if it hadn't been for the actions that the people decided to take, wrong or right, then this thing would be swept under the rug and nothing would be happening. The police wouldn't be convicted. And nothing will happen. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but at the same time, these are the type of things that people have to resort to make justice take place.
And it's so deep.
It's
so deep. The thing I think makes me tired and exhausted and frustrated more than anything else is that these people are not asking for radical political change. They're asking for damn government to do its job. That's all they're asking. They have to. I remember Trayvon Martin. We had to like march for 2 months just to get them to actually say, okay, we need to charge you, right? The government is supposed to be for no other population. Would they have to basically rebel in order to get one police officer charged, much less arrested, tried, and convicted? We still don't even know where he is, right?
He's left his home. We have no idea where he is. And are we going to break now? Can we get one more caller very quickly? Just one more. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air. Bruce, you there?
I got to contain my anger, but I'm going to tell it just the way it is.
You can tell.
So you're going on about Trayvon Martin. It's the same nonsense over and over again with this brown kid. It's unfortunate he was shot. It was unfortunate Trayvon Martin was shot. But I'm going to tell you just the way it is. And not just because I'm conservative, not just I'm a white guy. You guys delude yourself from the truth. Trayvon Martin was a thug, and so was Mr. Brown. And
hold on. I got a question for you. Is there anything in the Constitution of the United States that says that thugs don't get rights?
Deal with. But you won't, because you don't have the guts to do that.
All right, we have to take a brief break. We'll come right back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. With some of our other callers, 410-319-8888. We have Michael, and we're going to go to Brenda first and Melvin and hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Please stay with us.
Some search for the eaves. so I could get some phones. Rolling in my ride, chilling all alone.
Just hit the east side of the LBC on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweak. All of you search know what's up with 213.
So I hooked a left on 21 and Lewis. Some brothers shooting dice, so I said left.
This is Mark Steiner. We went out with Regulate by Warren G. and Nate Dogg. Dogg was born on this day in 1969, and we are coming back with Under Pressure by Queen, John Deacon of Queen, who was born on this day in 1951. And we understand one of our callers had not finished what he said. We'll come back to you in just a moment, Judith, so don't hang up. You will get to finish your statement. 410-319-8888. We are here, and of course I'm here with Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media, Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. I'm going to our Facebook pages, and my wife just sent me a thing saying people are on that page, so I will look to see what you're saying there. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Let me just read you this quick thing that came out of the Pew Charitable Trust. When it comes to what's going on right now, that I haven't chance, have not had a chance to read the entire piece, which I will this afternoon. But there are three points I'll bring out, and this study, the shooting that they found out, that the difference between African Americans and whites in America, looking at this, the shooting of an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, by a white police officer raises important issues about race. 80% of African Americans say yes, 37% of whites say yes. The police response to the shooting has gone too far. 65% of African Americans say yes, which is an interesting drop down, and 33% of white Americans says yes. They have no or not much confidence in the investigation into the shooting. 76% of African Americans say they do not have that confidence. 33% of white Americans say they do. And again, I go back to what I said the other day, that part of this to me is part of the Obama effect, what I call this large body of Americans who voted in 2008 to put Obama into office because they wanted a new America, because they saw that in the embodiment of a black person running for president, and the complexity of all that. No, not saying everybody agrees with everything there, but that's interesting. These stats kind of hold up that whole theory, but also the complexity of how people think about where this is taking us as a society across the board, because you see the drop in people who think that it's gone too far. Was almost a 15% drop in the African-American community thinking the police have gone too far. So let's talk about the complexity of 410-319-8888. Brenda, you're on the air.
I want to say, this is about the third or the fourth time, and I'm going to say how modern times that this has flared up. If you just look at it, every 10, 20 years, the same issue, racial issue, is always cited by Caucasian people. And my whole point is this. It's just impossible to get justice from a people who don't even think that you are worthy of justice, because they don't even think that you are as good as a person as they are. They don't even think you are a whole human being, as is evidenced by their own constitution. I think the solution for black people is stop trying to get justice from those who don't even want to give them justice. Go to their own selves, get their own land, like they was told years ago, get their own school. Teach their own people. What do they teach our children now? Look, they don't even know their own history. All they know is other people's history. Everybody in the world learns their own history before they learn every other person's history. We have learned everybody else's history and still don't know half our own history. How can we? The tree cannot grow if the root is not strong and nourished. And that's what's happening in this country. We're never going to get justice from Caucasian people. They have no intention. It was not created to give us justice. We was created to be slaves, and that's what they want. Now we are mental slaves. It's not going to change no more. It's on another level, and that's what I need to say.
Thank you, Brenda. You have a thought, Lester?
I don't think we're going to one way to think about it is not so much will someone give us justice, right? It's questions, can we kind of take justice, right? That we've got a long history, even given what's happened in Ferguson. If the situation were as dire as the caller posited, we'd have far many more Michael Browns than what we in fact have, right? And I'm not suggesting that what we have is perfect, far from it. I'm suggesting that in large part because of black protest that's been successful, we've made the what changes we've made. There have been number of changes that have been made going back 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. I mean, the viewpoint is very understandable. I get that. But there's a range of things we can't really understand if we believe that black people have been significantly psychologically damaged by the lack of their history, whether you're talking about black history broadly considered or even just in my family. There's a range of things that a psychologically damaged people that we wouldn't have predicted if we're talking about a psychologically damaged people.
And it's also a very complex question. I think that, Brenda, what you raised is something we should come back to, which is the question of just where America is, where we are in terms of white and black in America and brown and the divide we have, what history really means, what we really are teaching and who we are. I think are important subjects to kind of really kind of wrestle with in a very honest way.
One real quick addition. The one thing I do agree with is black people need our own institutions. We're going to be taxpayers. We don't need to separate. We don't need to get our, but we do need our own institutions.
And that's, I think, something that I've been thinking and writing back in response to what Leaders for Beautiful Struggle wrote that I plan to bring on the airwaves here in the next month after we've really had a time to wrestle with it. Because I think it's a complex thing, and I think that that Lester and I agree and disagree on certain points of that, and it'd be important to have this discussion. Just throw it out here and let's have that. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to Michael on line six.
Equity matters, right? And so I've been thinking about what your premise was, Mark, about the American people and the body politic, and I think you're right, but I take a little issue that, I think America has wanted to change because we're a sick body, a sick nation. But I don't think that they agree that, Obama was necessarily the change. And I think you're seeing... When you introduce a medicine to a sick body, the antibodies respond and the healthy cells respond. And so, you're seeing all this virulence. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there's an allergic reaction to him in some quarters. And all we're seeing is it coming, the toxins coming to the fore, right? And, when you think about life and life expectancy... this is why there's a significant life expectancy difference for African Americans, right? I mean, his life is cut short. That impacts the entire life expectancy. But what's really interesting about that analogy and metaphor is that all that was already there, right? We're just seeing it come to the fore. So all the pressure of living in that city that goes on a daily basis has always been there. And it just took this incident to come out. And, yes, African Americans are sick, but so are white folks. And we're all infected and sick by this thing called racism and structural racism. And we have to understand that it's not an altruistic thing, that we're all equally sick and infected. And I would just offer the last thought that this guy David Castro wrote a brilliant book on, sort of these fallacies of leadership that we have, right? This messiah fallacy, this hero fallacy, and what he called the fallacy of leadership nostalgia that work together that really prevent the common people, the average everyday people, from being creative and for having generative leadership. And we got to really look at that, because if you look at the leaders in Ferguson, even the African-American ones, they're just out of touch. And it's really easy to do that. And we have a model where it's like, come take me to your leader. What we need to be looking at, how does the common voice get lifted up? Because I think the earlier call was right, that this is with the militarization of police forces and the Oath Keepers, and this is going to happen over and over again unless we deal with some root causes. So I just wanted to share those thoughts and get you all's response.
Thank you so much. And I think that's a very important statement to make. And I think that itself is something that you and I have talked about having more programs in the air with Equity Matters just about that. And I think we have to bring those discussions and bring a larger community and world into those discussions to make that happen. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go back to a caller called in earlier. Judith, we have a lot of callers, so please.
Very quickly, I just wanted to make a statement. Something I have not heard yet is the fact that the our government, that taxpayers paid for these military weapons, and is it legal for our government to just give these states or allow these states to just get these types of weapons? where is civil liberties in this situation? Is it legal? Was it legal for them to just give away military weaponry to states without any taxpayers knowing any of this? That I have not heard. Where is the legal boundary? What gave them the right to just give these what type of weapons to cities? And where, this to me, what civil liberties, these are the things they should be
right
on top of. I have not heard that yet. And thank you for taking my call back.
Judith, thank you for, I'm sorry we cut you off earlier. But just those things happen to roll quick here sometimes. I think that we talked a bit about this on the air yesterday. This is directly descended from the 9/11 attacks, when this was used as a reason to invest in these armaments with local police. Mm-hmm. $4.5 billion has been spent since that time. But the interesting twist to that is that they have been selling, they being the federal government, to local police departments, this weaponry at a highly reduced rate. So that $4.5 billion is going much further than it would have. In other words, what I mean is a 300,000, what I read was, I think it was, I'm going to get the number, maybe $200,000 vehicle, armored vehicle, was sold to local police departments for $4,500. So they're able to get the surplus equipment into the hands of police at a much less rate. So that money they're spending goes a lot farther. And I think that there's a lot real question here. And I think that one of the things I hope Ferguson has raised in this country is the question of militarily arming our police and what that means, and should we be doing it? And I think this is an important question for us to say. Do we really need to, do our local police need the weapons of the U.S. military?
Yeah, there aren't that many issues given the way Congress is lined up, and given the way that racial segregation patterns shape how Congress looks as far as party control. But this is actually an issue that could potentially go across the aisle. So a House Democrat has already released a bill to demilitarize the police. Republican Rand Paul has spoken out against against the militarization of the police. So it's possible that you can gain some, that this is an issue we can gain traction on pretty quickly. But if not, it's something that people have been engaging in long-term struggle against. It's just about growing those numbers.
And it's all tied into the pervasiveness of the people, police watching citizens in this city and mm-hmm. cities across America, but not with hidden cameras, with cameras on poles, with handheld cameras and demonstrations. All these things go together. 410-319-8888. Let's get a couple of callers in here in a row. We have about 18 minutes left in our segment here. Let's go to Melvin. You've been holding on for the whole show. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to comment basically regarding the elders not bringing up their part to raise the next generation. And I think that's very true. And we're looking at a generation where it takes a college education in order just to make basic living. And I think what we need to do is, I think we need legislation that will give high school graduates something, some monetary gift from completing high school, because who can afford to spend $100,000 in college? And many of these parents don't feel as though they have the responsibility to take care of the youth. And that's why we have so many youth out now who are going by their own means to survive. And, and this is where the fallout really begins. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you so much, Melvin.
Yeah, I think that the idea of giving people resources to go to school is a no-brainer, right? We've put, since Reagan in 1980, we've put more and more responsibility on individuals to pay for college, either through direct loot or in the form of loans instead of grants. To the extent we've got scholarships, scholarships are now mostly merit-based rather than need-based. We need to move aggressively to make education as close to free as we can possibly get it. I am very reluctant to cast blame on people for the choices they make in the aggregate with kids. I mean, the economy is doing a job on folks. So, I mean, it's the job we've taken for granted, we've taken for granted the huge responsibilities that are increasingly placed on the backs of citizens, responsibilities that government used to pay for. So now we're expecting regular folk to work 2-3 jobs. We're expecting them to be good at their jobs. We're expecting them to hustle on the side. We're expecting them to be parents. We're expecting them to be partners. And we're taking away most of the resources they need to do that stuff, right? I mean, so given that, I focus on political solutions. I focus on political problems. I do so not only because I think it's accurate, that is, it tells the story better, it gets the story right, but I think that it's the politics from, you know, people are lazy and people just don't want to take responsibility for their own kids. The politics that come from that are the politics that we have.
Right.
Right?
I agree with that. I think we instead of putting the money into military armament and $4.45 billion into giving military armament to police, why not put that into our children and into our communities?
That's it.
410-319-8888. And I think that shows you, I mean, even in Ferguson, when we gave you the quote earlier, is that pull back the police, pull back the army, let the people have some control of their community and take it back, which can happen. Yeah. You see it every day there, but we're not allowing it. They're not allowing it to happen. They're not allowing it to happen. 410-319-8888. Meredith, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Meredith.
I have been so disturbed about this. I just feel like I don't understand why the killer was allowed to literally flee the county. Nobody knows where he is. And in terms of due process, a proper investigation, you know, if this was somewhere overseas, we'd be talking about Kangaroo Courts, Banana Republic. But this is at home. Why has this man been allowed to be on administrative leave? He's getting paid with the citizens' money, and the citizens are calling for justice, and yet he is allowed to live freely while this child is dead. What is the justice in that? And I think that should be pursued. I need to also see, we also need to see a dossier on him. Who is he exactly? His history and his record as a public servant, and we really need to delve deep into his profile and the profile of his family as well, because we may see a pattern of racist behavior in his family and also in his professional profile as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a tough one. I mean, and just to play the other side, the devil's advocate for just a moment, not to necessarily agree with everything I'm about to say, but just playing that role, is that when police officers are involved in these killings, they have to be held to a higher standard of justice. They need to be judged by, I think, an outside body, not by the police themselves, to bring justice to the fore. But I think that and he should be on administrative leave, or leave with or without pay, is something you can argue about. Mm-hmm. But to have him hidden like this, I think, is a huge mistake. And this happens over and over and over again, whether it was a police officer in California who was seen beating that poor woman on the freeway because he had a bad day, he said. He was angry, so he beat this woman on the freeway.
Yeah.
A black woman on the freeway, let me add, and a white officer beating a black woman.
51-year-old.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's something afoot here. We need to begin to demand and think about a change in the culture of our police and the politics of our policing in America. That has to happen. And I'm saying this as a man whose nephew is a cop, who has police who are my students and friends.
Yeah.
And so it's not, you know, it's not about that. This is about changing the nature of policing in America, which has to be part of the top part of our discussion.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I've just been thinking, like, what if Michael Brown were a cop, right? How, for example, would Fox News cover this, right? We probably have, like, hourly updates. Have you seen this guy? You know, with pictures, full dossier. I don't necessarily agree with the idea that we need to know about his family, right? Because the family didn't kill Michael Brown.
Right.
You know, the cop did. But I do think that we need as much transparency, not just in the police officer, for the police officer, but we need as much transparency about about the Ferguson Police Department record, right? Because we've already got signs of a cover-up. We've got signs.
Right.
Right. The governor himself says, "Wow, you're only, you know, when the police officer reveals that Michael Brown was to potentially involved in a crime beforehand. The governor says the only reason you could possibly put that out there is character assassination. Why would you do that? The governor of the state of Missouri says that.
And I think that we will talk in the coming days as well. I'm going to go right to the phones here to let you know that the whole issue of how he was killed, that there's a lot of speculation at the moment. What we do know is that a gunshot to the head killed Michael Brown. And so we're looking forward to these kind of independent reports about what exactly happened, because a 6'4" man being shot in the head by a man who was shorter than he raises a lot of issues, to say the least. 410-319-8888. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mitchell. Good morning.
Hey,
what's up, Mitch?
This is a question is specifically for you. You were part of the civil rights movement for a long time. I want to talk about the police officer, the black police officer that they keep saying is this excellent, good guy. Part of the lessons learned, in my opinion, they put this so-called good black face out there, and in the day he does all of this good stuff, and then at night they do all these strong arm tactics. I mean, it's just like good cop, bad cop. And then when it happens, he says it's justified. And this is the other thing is, you being a part of that movement, you know in every part of that movement that there were provocateurs, that people that come out there to create trouble, and they're part of the institutional behavior, part of people that are put out there. I'm not saying that that's necessarily so, but where is the journalism, Mark? Here, they say, the police say something happens. They say somebody got shot. They say this happened. And nobody in journalism follows up and goes to the hospital to see where these people are. There's no corroboration of anything. The journalism in this is just hearsay and conjecture. This is outrageous on every institutional level. The journalism is just pathetic, Mark.
I agree. Let's just jump right in here. Since you addressed it to me, let me just say this very quickly. I think that, you know, this morning when I came in here, I said to my producers, where are the articles I'm looking for about what people are saying about what the police are saying? Who's investigating it? You had to dig. I had to Google search blogs from Ferguson, tweets from Ferguson, to find people in the community who were trying to find out what was going on behind and what they said, because it isn't there. And I think journalism in America is in an abysmal place when it comes to issues like this, and when it comes to holding our government to task, going underneath the issues to find out what's going on. We should know what's happening. We don't know what's happening. We'll say this, that the police are arresting journalists. The ones who are trying to do the job from Al Jazeera, from Russian TV, and others who are actually getting behind the scenes are being arrested and pushed out.
Yeah,
that's happening as well.
That's really the first piece, right? So as bad a state of journalism is in, the first piece is, what are the police doing to prevent journalists from doing their jobs, right? So I mentioned Jelani Cobb earlier. He's there for the New Yorker. He tried to get behind Ferguson lines.
Right.
He couldn't even get through.
Right.
Through the lines, because they're like, okay, you know, journalists are being arrested. And he actually tried to do it from a number of different angles. He just couldn't cut through the thick blue line in this case. So I think that's the first place to start, is, okay, what's the police doing to keep the press from doing its job? Everything else after that is just kind of a detail. The police in this case, and again, you compare what's happening here to L.A. or Detroit or Newark or Baltimore or a range of other instances, this is far, far, far less violent, far, far, far more organized. But the police response is so incredibly more toxic and heavy-handed, arguably.
Let's get a couple of very quick calls in here. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Brian. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on two things. The first thing being, there is no doubt that the militarized local police is an issue, a major issue in this country. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, you guys seem to keep making this young man out to be some sort of saint.
I never nothing did that.
He's the precipitator of the entire incident. Had he not been walking down the middle of the street the way he was, which is fact, it's not denied, he would not be dead today.
Can you do me a favor? Could you say, when you say walking down the middle of the street the way he was, what do you mean?
I'm sorry, the reason he was pulled over by the police officer, which is not disputed, was because he was walking down the middle of the street and the police officer asked him not to. That's not in dispute. Had he not been walking down the middle of the street and abiding by regular, normal societal rules of walking on a sidewalk as opposed to walking down the middle of the street, the situation would not have occurred.
So you're suggesting now that it should be a crime punishable by death to walk down the middle of the street?
That's absurd for you to even make that claim, because that is not even remotely close to what I said.
Didn't you just say if he wouldn't have walked down the middle of the street, what happened wouldn't have happened?
Hey, there's a cause and effect here.
Yeah, so the cause is him walking down the middle of the street, and the effect is him getting killed. That's what you're suggesting, right?
It's called jaywalking.
So jaywalking should be a crime punishable by death.
That's not what I'm saying. You're putting words in my mouth again, and it's entirely just disrespectful, to be honest with you.
So what are you saying, Brian?
This conversation, when you're going to sit there and say, I'm saying that jaywalkers should be killed. That's not what I'm saying. There's a level of responsibility here, a level of responsibility that is being denied by so many people about the young man's actions that led to the death.
Okay, I hear what you're saying, and this is Mark Steiner now, and what I will comment of what you're saying, Brian, and I hear what you're saying, is that if someone's walking down the middle of the street and a police officer tries to tell you to stop and you don't stop, then the police officer's job is to call for backup if he thinks he needs it or she needs it to confront the individual who's walking down the middle of the street, if in fact it happened. But this young man, if walked down the middle of the street, no matter what happened, was shot and shot in the head.
He was shot six times.
Six times.
Yeah.
So there's something else here besides walking down the middle of the street. And I think that young people display white, black, brown, native people on all levels display a certain amount of bravado in life. And that happens. That doesn't mean you get that there's something else here that's going to be more important than his walking down the middle of the street, is what I'm saying. I'm not painting him as a saint. I don't even know the man. I have no idea what he was like.
And the reason I'm pushing you, Brian, is because it does sound kind of goofy. But the other thing is that I grew up in Inkster, Michigan, walking down the middle of the street from about 10 years old to when I went to college in 18. And that type of behavior, at the very most, is maybe guilty of maybe I deserved a citation. But to make but there are a number of leaps. Once we say, okay, the police stopped him, then there are a range of things that should have happened at that point if we lived in a normal government. But being shot six times isn't really one of them. So that's why we haven't focused on, or that's why, at least in my case, that's why I haven't focused on that. Because a guy should be able to jaywalk in the middle of the street and live.
So first of all, let me thank all the people who have called in today. We do have to take a break here. We have next segment that is planned every week on soundbites that we have to do out of contractual agreement because we also want to do it. I want to thank Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and African Studies at Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, for being my co-host this hour. I want to thank all of you for calling in, writing in, and bringing your ideas to the airwaves. And let me promise you that what's going to happen over the next 3 days is that each day we'll be focusing an hour or more on Ferguson, its outcome, all the issues surrounding it. We'll have a chance for all these voices didn't get on today to come on the air to talk about this because we all have something to say. We're all thinking about this. And we have to analyze it and bring what we know to the airwaves from many perspectives, which we will be doing. So it's good to have you all with us. And stay tuned. We'll be right back with Soundbites. And Lester, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Stumping and the jam is pumping. Look ahead, the crowd is jumping. Pump it up a little more. Get the party going on the dance floor. See, 'cause that's where the party's at, and you find out if you do that.